At Baptist Health, it's our mission to care for you when you're injured or sick and help you stay healthy and fit. Welcome to the Baptist Health Talk Podcast, where our respected experts bring you timely, practical health and wellness information to improve your family's quality of life.
Lung cancer is the number one cancer killer in the United States every year. We've known for decades that tobacco smoking increases one's risk of developing lung cancer multiple fold, though many lung cancers do occur in non-smokers. And while smoking rates across the country are on a downward trend, the effects of smoking can linger on. It should be noted that the American Cancer Society suggests there are over 5 million smokers or previous smokers who should undergo annual screenings for lung cancer, with early detection being the best shot at beating the deadly disease. Here to talk to us about lung cancer, with a particular emphasis on early detection and treatment, is Dr. Mark Dulewski. Dr. Dulewski is chairman of the Thoracic Surgery Oncology Department at Miami Cancer Institute and the director of thoracic robotics throughout Baptist Health South Florida. And of course, I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Fialco, Chief Medical Executive and Population Health Officer for Baptist Health. Welcome to the podcast, Mark. To our listeners, please understand Dr. Dulewski is in a poor cell reception area, and there is some dropouts in the conversation, but I do think the conversation is well worth listening to, and I think we'll all be able to glean great information from this. So again, welcome to the podcast, Mark.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction.
So let's get going, hitting off the board. I mean, obviously, lung cancer, a very important topic and very broad. But for the purposes of this conversation, let's just start with some basic facts. Are there different types of lung cancers? And if so, which are the more common ones?
So lung cancer is grouped into two different main categories. The first category is small cell carcinoma, which accounts for about 20% of lung cancers that we diagnose throughout the United States annually. It is related to smoking use. And then the larger group is called non-small cell or large cell carcinoma, which accounts for the rest, about 80% of the other types of cancer, with rare exceptions. There's some smaller groups such as carcinoid tumors and neuroendocrine tumors and large cell carcinomas, which account for a very small percentage. But the largest group is the non-small cell carcinomas that we diagnose on an annual basis.
Are there differences in, we'll say, treatment and prognoses between non-small cell and small cell?
So, excellent question. So that's why they're grouped into those two different categories, because the small cell carcinomas tend to be very aggressive. They tend to present 95% of the time in its advanced stages. And rarely do we ever catch small cell carcinomas in the early stages. They would be amenable to surgery. So that group generally is treated non-operatively with a combination of chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and radiation. And then the larger group, the non-small cells, which is divided in general into adenocarcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas, are treated with surgery primarily when they're discovered in their early stages, stage 1 through 3, and then the advanced stages generally are treated with non-operative therapy, such as chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and radiation.
So that's interesting. I wasn't aware of those statistics. Let's talk about the small cell for a second, then obviously we'll get into the non-small cell, since, as you said, that's about 80% of the people with lung cancer. The small cell is the one that's more related to tobacco exposure, correct?
Yes, it's highly likely if you're diagnosed with small cell that you used a tobacco product at some time in your life. Not all patients. There are some rare small cell carcinomas that we identify in young patients. We don't quite link them to tobacco use, but the majority of them that we diagnose are in smokers.
So for the screening recommendations we're going to ask you to go into in a second, it's fair to say, because the screening is around smoking history or smokers, and you said the small cell, which is the one that's associated with smoking, generally presents later in its course. Is that why we heavily emphasize the smoker as the person who should be screened? Is that the logic behind that?
Well, let me clarify a little bit. Small cell is highly related to tobacco use, but also a large percentage of the non-small cells are also related to tobacco.
But we
are seeing a group of patients, particularly women between the ages of 50 and 70, who are non-smokers, that are presenting with adenocarcinoma that we do not believe is linked to tobacco use primarily. We don't quite know exactly what the identifiable risk factors are for that group of patients. There has been some recent data that's been published that environmental pollutions can trigger genetic alterations within the genome of a patient that may be contributing to that incidence of adenocarcinoma in that group of females. But the rest of the non-small cells primarily are also influenced by tobacco use.
So what are the current screening recommendations and methodologies for lung cancer?
So they recently changed, and I anticipate that the screening criteria will change as years go by, because there's continual epidemiological review of the data. And the primary motivation of any type of screening is to capture the most highest risk population. And so they recently changed based on, you know, a review of the epidemiology, and they expanded the criteria from 55 years as the youngest patient to 50. So they lowered it to 50 and then kept it at 80. So we expanded the age group of patients, and that alone will increase the volume of patients that potentially qualify for screening to 5 million more patients. So hopefully we'll capture more patients. And then also they reduced the length of smoking to 20 years, 20 pack years, which will also expand the population of patients that are at risk for lung cancer and should be screened appropriately.
Does the screening require a physician's prescription, or are there screening methodologies where people who meet those criteria can get scans?
It does require that a physician order a screening study for insurance purposes. There are programs set up within Baptist that if you don't meet those criteria, that you can get a screen study. And we set up those programs primarily to try to allow patients who may have a strong family history of lung cancer, particularly in a family member who's a non-smoker. They don't necessarily qualify under the criteria, and insurance won't necessarily agree to reimburse for that. But we know that those patients are at higher risk than the population of patients that don't have a family history. And so we've made arrangements for patients to get screening if they fall into that category of patients for a nominal charge.
And how does one access that? Is it through the website? Is it through physician or primary care office? How would someone be able to gain that? Calling Miami Cancer Institute?
Yes, it's captured. You can gain access to it through the Baptist Health internet site and put in lung screening program, and it'll direct you to the appropriate website in order to get information on how to access the program. And then most primary care physicians are aware of lung screening programs, so they can help the patient access that program as well.
Two last questions on the screening. First is, how frequently should one get the screening done if they meet the criteria of smoking history, or as you say, secondhand exposure?
So a first-time candidate for the lung screening program would generally have their first screen, and if there's no significant abnormalities that suggest that they have a pulmonary nodule that needs further follow-up, they will be offered a screening study every year going forward, and they'll be tracked in our database, and the nurse navigator will reach out to them on an annual basis and communicate to them when they should come in for a screen in the future. We will also communicate with their primary care physician so that the patients are lost follow-up, and the onus doesn't fall on the responsibility of their primary care to make sure that they get their screen. So it's automatically done through our nurse navigator and the database that we have for each patient.
And then my other question before we move on is, obviously as a surgeon, you're exposure is a little skewed, especially when you mentioned that many of the small cells don't get treated with surgery. But do you have any sense at, let's say, the Miami Cancer Institute, how many patients with lung cancer are brought in, if you will, or referred or make or seen because of screening abnormalities, or how many based on other, you know, symptoms or x-rays, which we'll get into in a second? In other words, what percent are actually as a result of the screening finding these early detections of the cancer?
So that's a very good question. And it's interesting. I'm going to answer it in sort of a twofold manner. So the majority of patients who are diagnosed with lung cancer in the United States and around the world present with advanced stage 3 and stage 4. And that accounts for as much as, you know, 65 to 75% of patients. So it's when you present with symptoms, oftentimes the cancer is quite advanced. Right? The screening population is going up in the United States, but we still struggle with getting people to recognize that they're candidates for screening. Believe it or not, in the general population, we screen less than 6% of the population that's at risk. And it also goes down even further to 3% in the Hispanic population and in the Afro-American population, because those, for various social economic reasons, have less access to screening or the education about screening. So we're doing a very poor job overall at screening the at-risk population. That's where community awareness programs like this come into significance, because it's very important to get the word out.
That's remarkable, and how kind of unfortunate that we have a well-established evidence-based support for these screening tests. They're safe and they're cost-effective, if you will, and we're getting to such a small percent of those at the highest risk. So well said, and I'm glad our efforts continue to expose more and more people who have the opportunity to get these screening tests and the subsequent treatment, in the Baptist area. Talk a little bit about symptoms. You mentioned that most present later in the course of their lung cancer journey. What would be, we'll say, earlier symptoms, or what are the kind of symptoms that we want to educate the listeners to say, hey, listen, obviously get this checked out sooner rather than later?
So the symptoms can be a wide variety of symptoms, but the most common symptom that patient presents with is a cough, a non-productive cough. And you can imagine that is, you know, a symptom that is difficult to sort of focus on, because smokers in general have a cough every day. So they don't really notice all of a sudden that the cough has developed. And so a cough in and of itself is a symptom and an early sign of lung cancer. But oftentimes patients don't pursue healthcare evaluation because of a cough. And then the other symptoms that show up are more suggestive of advanced disease, such as bone pain, weight loss, hemoptysis, which is coughing up of blood, and neurological issues like imbalance, instability, headaches would suggest that there is advanced cancer going on and metastatic disease to parts of the body that are contributing to those symptoms.
So the cough would be, as you said, the most common. I'm, you know, in the stages of a cold right now, an upper respiratory tract infection. So, you know, dry cough is not something that's infrequent. Allergies, all the other confounding causes of that.
Exactly.
So I guess it's really, you know, the person's determination of when you have a dry cough and it's lasting a little bit longer or just doesn't seem right, obviously go see your primary care doctor as soon as you can, and then they'll make the assessment. And then what's the general assessment? Is it a chest x-ray, or what generally gets done to differentiate in the early stages, let's say, a cough from something problematic or something that could be explained otherwise?
So that's an interesting question. And this is where the dilemma lies, is that oftentimes not only is the patient not educated well enough to understand, you know, what a cough may mean or whether they're at risk for lung cancer, but even primary care physicians throughout the country often overlook a presenting symptom such as a cough, or even hemoptysis sometimes. They'll do an x-ray, they'll see a little bit of infiltrate in the lung, and the first trigger is to diagnose that patient with pneumonia. And they're given antibiotics, and then they're followed up months later with another chest x-ray or CT scan, and often there's significant delay. Perhaps the patient gets better after a short course of antibiotics and never comes back to the primary care physician until a couple of years later. And so we are missing patients with the diagnosis of lung cancer because of the lack of education throughout the medical community and also the community in general. So it's very important to focus on the risk factors. This is a no-brainer, John. It's very easy to pick out the at-risk population, and you know, comparing this to prostate cancer and colon cancer and breast cancer, virtually every male and every female is at risk for those disease processes. Here we have a red flag on the high-risk population, and it should be very easy to identify those folks and get those folks appropriately screened. And what's more important for the audience to realize is if you're diagnosed with a lung cancer on a screening study, as opposed to when you present the cough, you have about a 92% risk or a 92% chance of being cured with surgery if it's caught in the early stages, as compared to about 75 to 80% after you present with a cough. So that's a significant improvement in long-term survival. And the other advantage is that you don't have to spend all the money on treating patients with advanced disease. So it reduces the overall cost of healthcare for the patient population when you catch it in the early stages as opposed to the advanced stages, because that's where most of the money is spent treating patients at their end of life with chemotherapy and radiation and treating all the palliative, you know, the complications with palliative therapy.
That's, you know, fantastic insight, Mark. And again, I really appreciate, you know, articulating those points. And it kind of gives a little bit of a, I'll say, an optimistic component. So let's follow up with that, you know, as we come to near the end of this information. So what have we seen regarding survival rates with lung cancer? Have they been improving? And if so, to what do you attribute those numbers?
So that's an excellent question. And there is some headways that we've made in the treatment of lung cancer, both from a surgical standpoint and also from a medical oncology and radiation oncology standpoint. You know, one of the things that the founders of Miami Cancer Institute wanted to provide for patient population is state-of-the-art care, such as, you know, the most advanced radiation technology, the most advanced medical oncology and clinical trials, as well as the most advanced technology for providing surgical therapy to our patients. And so just to give you a summary of the advancements we've made that's helped improve overall survival with respect to surgery, we have now robotics, which allows us to do very complex surgery that we used to do through an open approach with tiny pencil-sized incisions, basically four tiny pencil-sized incisions to do the entire operation. The patient usually spends the night in the hospital and routinely goes home the next day after a major lung resection. So that's changed the dynamic quite differently. Now, robotic surgery has been demonstrated to be probably the most successful way of doing cancer surgery. We've shown in multi-institutional trials that robotic surgery is associated with a longer five-year survival compared to open surgery and VAT surgery. So there is some advantages to seeking out an institution that provides access to robotic surgery. From the radiation oncology standpoint, there's a lot of state-of-the-art technology that MCI has instituted, such as proton therapy. In the past, radiation has been associated with a lot of side effects for our patient population, and oftentimes the complications related to radiation prevent us from offering the patient surgery following radiation and so forth. So proton beam has less toxicity to our patients than traditional radiation. And then there's also targeted radiation such as CyberKnife that allows us to treat lesions in the brain and in the bone more effectively with very little side effects. So the real advancements that have happened in the last 5 to 10 years is in medical oncology and immunology and targeted therapy. So nowadays, all tumors are genetically studied. In other words, we map the genome of the tumor. And based on, you know, numerous databases and historical response rates to chemotherapy and immunotherapy, we can identify which patients are going to respond to which drugs more effectively. So compare this to the way we used to treat patients with lung cancer. We used to diagnose the patient with large cell, non-small cell or small cell carcinoma. We'd pick our favorite drug off the shelf and give it to the patient and then scan the patient 6 months later to see if they responded. And a lot of them didn't respond. Nowadays, we can predict based on the genome of the tumor what drug is going to work best in that patient. In addition, we have targeted therapy. So if a patient has a particular tumor marker on the cell surface like ROS or EGFR, we can use targeted antibodies that deliver chemotherapy to that cell. And so it's become much more effective. And believe it or not, patients, even with advanced cancer, such as stage 4 cancer, are living 5 to 7 years longer with their disease and having a very productive, good quality of life. And we were never able to achieve that in the past. And one fortunate thing to remember is that the non-smoking patient who has lung cancer tends to have genetic mutations that are targetable, that are actionable. And so those patients that have cancer unrelated to tobacco use tend to have a higher propensity of being able to respond to some of these newer targeted therapies, which has been a huge advance in treatment of lung cancer in the last 5 to 10 years.
It's just fascinating, Mark. Do you see, I mean, in the days, you know, in my exposure to oncology, which goes back, you know, decades other than, you know, mutual patients and whatnot, which, by the way, we do have a lot of patients we mutually follow, and the recuperation and back to normal life from the robotic surgery that you lead, it really is remarkable, and it really is a game changer in people with cancer who require surgery. But do you see, like, you know, the idea of the staging of cancer based on size maybe becoming less relevant than the genetics as we go further, or will there always be that staging based on size and extension? I mean, it seems like if it's
so, that's an interesting,
right?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
That's a very interesting question. And I think that we will continue to have a TNM staging criteria to simply try to predict what the patient's likelihood of response to some of the therapies and the long-term survival. I think that will be very useful to categorize patients into particular categories based on the survival of the therapies that we offer. But I agree, going forward, the genome of the tumor, all cancers, is going to be the most important factor going forward. And there's some recent advancements in targeted therapy now that allows you to identify those genetic mutations and attach a drug to an antibody that attaches to that receptor on the cell and delivers the drug inside the particular tumor cell, so that there's no other cells in the body that are affected by the chemotherapy or the targeted therapy. So it's going to develop in a sense so that you're going to have these drugs with very little side effects, very little complications. And I envision in the future, surgery may not actually be necessary. We might have to just simply biopsy these tumors, get a genetic mapping of the tumor, and then deliver chemotherapy or targeted therapy directly to the tumor cell surface. And that will be the mainstay treatment for lung cancer and all cancers going forward.
Well, there'll be nothing wrong if we relegate the robots one day to very expensive paperweights because of
those. Exactly.
Anyway, Mark, again, appreciate your time and insights. I can go on for a long time learning from you. We're so fortunate at Baptist Health to have someone of your expertise and passion and surgical prowess. Any final comments you want to make to the listeners, either something that we didn't say or something you want to reiterate?
I would like to end this session with a simple statement of fact that smoking is one of the worst things that an individual can do or adopt in their life. It not only increases their risks of lung cancer, it increases their risks of all different types of cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer. It influences the genetics or the genetic rearrangements that occur as a result of tobacco use that put patients at risk for all cancers. And on top of that, it increases other disease processes. And you're familiar with your area of expertise, sure. Cardiovascular. Sure. It increases your risk of cardiovascular disease, peripheral vascular disease, hypertension, and cardiovascular disease and cancer are the top two causes of death throughout the United States and the world. And if you simply avoid the use of tobacco, you can improve your likelihood of living by 10 to 20 years by simply avoiding the use of tobacco. So it's very important for our audience to recognize that and really strive to avoid the use of that toxic substance, combustible tobacco.
Absolutely well said. To our listeners, again, I really hope you all got great information from Dr. Dlugsky. Certainly the early detection screening, if you're at risk, go to your primary care doctor as a first line, and they'll certainly be well-versed in who should get screening and how and when. Don't smoke. Don't even start smoking. If you do smoke, seek whatever efforts are available to help you get rid of the addictive smoking. And if you have any symptoms that don't seem right, dry cough being the most prominent one, but other things, just always, as we said with all our podcasts, just get checked out by a medical professional. Don't learn your medical care from the internet and various other, you know, talking to friends and whatnot. Take care of yourself. Thank you so much, Mark. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, thank you, John, very much. I enjoyed our talk today. Nice. Have a good morning.
You too. And to our listeners, if you like what you've heard on this or any of our podcasts, please be sure to tell a friend or family member about us. If you have a comment or a suggestion for a future topic, please email us at baptisthealthtalk@baptisthealth.net. That's baptisthealthtalk@baptisthealth.net. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening.
Find additional valuable health and wellness information on our resource blog at baptisthealth.net/news. And be sure to interact with us on our social media channels for live and upcoming events. This podcast is brought to you by Baptist Health, the warmer side of care.